On Radio Gorgeous today, I'm welcoming a woman who's having a very successful career in the world of horse racing. She lives in a beautiful cottage on a shingle beach on the edge of the English Channel. She spends her life trying to keep her life in balance. She has an old English sheepdog called Alfred, who she walks. She has now written a book called A Little Book of Permission. She is Susie Sourwine, and I'd like to welcome her to Radio Gorgeous. Hi, welcome. Hi.
Thank you so much. I'm very pleased to be here.
So, Susie, first of all, I want you to read the first page of your book, and we'll go on from there.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much. So, here, as we begin, let's get this over and save you some time. You don't have to abandon yourself. You don't have to accept it as well-meaning. You don't have to accept the invitation. You don't have to accommodate the request. You don't have to agree with my position. You don't have to always be nice.
So your book is, at the beginning, it's a big thing saying have to, should do, required to, must be, ought to, need to, duty to. And then the whole book, it says it's you don't have to. What's it all about, Susie?
It's basically a list of all the things I could think of over a period of time, of the things that we may tell ourselves we have to do, but in reality, we have a lot more choice than our brains sometimes let us remember. So it's about kind of taking back that self-sovereignty and saying, I don't have to do this. I might choose to do it. I might want to do it, but I don't have to do it. I am not actually required. And, you know, it always makes me think of that, I think it's Paul Simon's song, The 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. Like, there are 50 ways. Like, there's not, you know, those are always the answers. And we can usually find 10 or more ways to do or not do anything. So I'm just trying to get people and myself to get back to the idea of making choices instead of being required to do things.
And it's also, it's like standing back, taking a breath and thinking, how can I do this differently? Or do I have to do it? And why, you know what I mean? It's questioning your whole life.
Yeah, it can get pretty intense. You know, a lot of it's, you know, some's very lighthearted and some very playful. But at the same time, I tried to hit some of the big ones that were, for me, were life-changing when I realized that actually I had a choice around this, about the, you know, about deciding about the kind of person I was or what was going to be important to me and the actions that I was going to take or the thoughts that I would let have a say or sway in my life.
Wow. So, what are these things that we must do, must be required to, need to, duty to? What sort of things are they?
The thing that kicked me off with this was, it's funny, we were, you know, thinking about femininity and being a woman and trying to figure out how I was supposed to be in the world. And there were a lot of opinions about what I was supposed to do. And I think all of us can be familiar with this, with depending on which ones you might struggle with are different, I think, for everyone. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of opinions out there about what you should do or have to do in order to be considered, you know,
a woman.
Yeah. And or, you know, yeah. Beautiful or even if that's important to you, like, yeah, you don't have to be beautiful. You can be just... Yeah. You know, whatever version you want of yourself. And so when I started kind of struggling with that, I found myself, and I talk about this in the introduction a little bit, I found myself fighting everything off. I spent my life like fighting off. So I was raised in the Catholic Church as a young girl, which was ridiculously horrible. You know, the first time I wasn't allowed to be an altar boy, because all I wanted to do was ring the bells. Like, I wanted the job to ring the bells, and I couldn't do it because I was a girl. And I started struggling with that, and all these, no, you should do this. You have to be this, as opposed to you can be. So
you've got to wear the white pretty dress and do Holy Communion and look perfect.
Yes. You know, I was, oh my gosh, well, that's a whole other story, but someday I'll tell you about what I did to the poor bishop on my confirmation when he asked me a question.
Go on, tell us. Come on, Susie, you've opened it up now.
I didn't tell him the right answer, so... I came from, my parents were divorced and my father lived very far away. And he was, you know, doing the kind of the royal line of innocuous questions. And he's like, so what does your father do? And I looked at him and I said, I have no idea.
Brilliant.
And he was just stunned. I unapologetically wasn't going to make it up.
You've been a rebel since the beginning, haven't you?
Yeah, I really have. I really have. I remember sitting in my... sixth grade class, and we had just moved to a different Canadian province, and they decided to have a debate in the class about abortion.
So how old were you?
11. Mm-hmm. And it was me and one guy, thank God, Paul St. Maurice sat next to me, against the rest of the class. And you know, it's difficult. Kind of the, yeah, those yeah, moments difficult. Get started, yeah. And mm. you. So mm. this is how I got here: is that mm. I was fighting this. I found myself fighting a lot of good fights, and what I noticed as time went on was that I was also fighting some really unnecessary fights, which was, you know, actually, if someone has an opinion about what I should or have to do, I have to allow that to influence me. And so this book was one of kind of my offering to allow other people to put some distance between things that they're told that are required of them or that they have to do, so that in order they can make a choice. And then you can, you know, you can relax a little bit more into yourself and turn your energy towards building something instead of fighting something that you don't care about anyway. Like, I really don't care what the Catholic Church wants me to do. I don't. So why should I fight that off anymore?
Yeah. Yeah. So do you think you were carrying ghosts and sayings and opinions from childhood upwards, and you were still reacting to them?
Oh, completely. And still to this day, you know, just write. I need to write another 4 editions personally of this book for me, because every day that I uncover more things that in my head were a should or a had to, and I was like, actually no, you know, whether it's even just, you know, what your clothes should look like for a job interview or for a conversation with a client and all those sort of things. It's like, actually no, I can make choices there.
So something must have gone wrong in your life, and you've got to tell us it, Susie.
Well, there are a lot of things went wrong in my life.
Okay, tell us the most dramatic one.
But in which context?
I don't know. You know it, don't you? You know the story, you've got to tell us.
What went wrong?
What went wrong from being you? You know what I mean? Because loads went wrong from being me, because I was such a rebel that it just, I kept making trouble, problems. What went wrong for you?
Oh, you know, I think the only thing that would have went wrong in that sense was that I would have made decisions not to be myself over and over and over again. So I would have conformed to other people's ideas or expectations about what was correct, when they may or may not have been really true to who I authentically was. I think I did that over and over and over and over, and I paid a price for it.
Give us some examples.
Even when I was, say, when I started out in the horse racing industry, I was really young. I was 19. I was still at university, and it was, you know, it was not a place where it was safe to be. If you had aspirations, it wasn't a very safe place to be incredibly feminine. And so I masculinized my wardrobe, my, you know, the thing. I'm like between 19 and 22 in that first job.
Okay,
I was
tell
shocked.
Us what you wore. What did you look like?
Oh, I just went to suits. Like, I just went to suits and, you know, it was the
Didn't
late
wear makeup.
90s. I had makeup on, but always not, very professional. Yeah, I was always... I was very beige in things where, you know, the color in intensity of color, not, you know, like navy like today or whatever, but a proper color was not a part of my.
So you were in denial about a part of yourself then?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Also, you probably thought you had to be a man to get on in racing world. I mean, it is the most male, one of the most male worlds, you know, out there, isn't it?
Absolutely. I was everything. In my, I was a man in every way except for body. And, you know, that's not okay.
So did you have gay relationships?
No.
So could you attract men because of being so male?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, because there was definitely some, but no long-term relationships until I moved here and really changed things up.
Wow.
That's a real, I hadn't thought about it that way. Thank you for that question.
Okay, brilliant. So... why did you feel this great sense of having to do? Where was the pressure from? Was it from God? Was it from the church? Or was it from yourself?
No, it was from me. Totally from me. I think I was always very... I was ambitious and fortunate. Very fortunate in my... you know, the tool of my intellect right from the time I was a child. And I think a lot of expectations get piled on you when, as soon as you're good with school or you're showing up in a particular way.
So you had straight A's.
yeah, definitely.
Wow.
Yeah,
and was your mother pleased?
Very, yeah. Mm. And of course, that all also brought in expectations of, oh, you're going to,
You're the clever one.
Yeah, and you'll go to, you know, so I was the second person in my family. I, you know, my my mom's one of eight children, and I was the second grandchild out of all of them to go to university.
Oh my God, so it was a really big deal.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, so there was obligations, I thought, that came with that, which I realized over time did not actually exist. Mm-hmm. Everybody just wanted you to be happy and to be successful in whatever way you decided that was. And, you know, and my mom was always such a huge supporter of my artistic and creative side. And it's really funny how I was able to, you know, kind of just only put that in service to my work, like my job, for a really long time, even though I had all the support in the world for it.
Well, I'm wondering, you say you're very ambitious, but your dad left, and I'm quite into kind of psychology, and a father is the relationship with a father for the girl is the most important thing for success in the world. If they don't have a good relationship with their father, success is really complicated. How was your relationship with your dad?
No, it was not a good relationship. It was a very painful relationship. And so, you know, gosh, we left. I didn't have any contact with him since I was, you know, just 10 until it was probably about, I saw him again when I was about 15, I think. And then I talked to him just before he died about a decade ago now.
And did you make amends?
Yeah, we did. We did. And he made amends, which was important. And in a way that I was able to actually embrace and move forward with.
Now, I wonder if that was the moment when your life came together a bit more.
Well, because, it's interesting. It's really close because I had already made, when I made the decisions to move here to the UK, was when it all came together when I realized I had worked myself almost to death, that had I didn't make a change, that was going to be where I was and how I felt was going to be the rest of my life. And I wasn't okay with that. So I packed everything up. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a house or whatever. And I got to move here. And I got to do it actually on my my paternal grandmother's ancestry, because she's from Scotland. Fantastic. So it was this really like this, it's almost like this gift.
From
my paternal side of my family, there was this gift of this new life, which has been really important. And I've been here now 9 years, and the entwining and untangling of that story has been really important.
No, it's very interesting about the father. Who were you trying to, this drive and this ambition, was it to prove it to your mother, your father, yourself?
I think I was trying to prove to the world that I was valuable. Okay. It was something I didn't believe about myself for a really long time, despite all the, you know, all the awards and all the popularity and the, you know, the I have a very smart friend who calls the Canadian condition the tyranny of nice, and I participated in that fully, you know.
Always thinking about others, trying to be kind, trying to, you know, be you know, thoughtful. Giving things up for people.
Absolutely no personal boundaries. Not a one.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what sort of things did that lead you into then? Were you saving people or were you just helping them?
A lot of helping and some saving. Absolutely. Yeah. Always willing to save, you know, and definitely always trying to save men that were in my, you know, the relationship ones, definitely saving those or making them better. Which
That's
is
really
done with that now.
Yeah.
But the it's always been, and that's what actually where kind of this book comes from, is that the helpfulness, the making it better for the next, whoever's behind me in line, and it doesn't mean by age, but just if somebody's following me on the path that I'm on, you know, it's my job to pull a few more brambles off, and that's what I attempted to do here. So I've always been very, you know, I've been a mentor, and I've stayed in connection with the, you know, the people that I've hoped to help, you know, through all of my moves, you know, in Canada, the US, and here, so.
So that's terribly tiring because you've got to kind of keep up all these different relationships. You've got to worry about them and you don't have time to think about yourself, do you?
Yeah, that was true. And before I had these self-care boundaries about, which I had to get by running away. Like I just ran away. and I had to do it again when I, you know, once I moved here, I literally just left London and went on a, you know, a little tour around the country with my old dog, which is my second book, which I'm working on. But I had to go do that because I didn't know about I didn't know, no one had, people taught me how to make successful businesses. People taught me about marketing. People taught me about all these wonderful things. The things that I never got taught and I had to learn for myself was how to manage my energy. And what, and by, I don't even mean in the, like the metaphysical sense, I just mean in what I actually have in my body without overdoing it. And now,
so was the ramifications from overdoing it? Can you tell us?
Numbness, absolute incredible numbness, exhaustion. I think.
Did you have ME or?
No. It took me, when I left my job in Seattle, it took me about 4 years, I think, here to be all right.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Like, and I didn't even know.
And really taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
You hadn't.
I had no idea. Like, I had no idea that how much every reserve I had of everything, of enthusiasm, of love, of whatever, was so depleted. And then as soon as I started making new relationships and things here, and I was like, oh, I only have so much. I didn't before. I don't know where I was pulling it from, but it wasn't, it was more than I needed to give.
So what brought on writing this book?
Well, when did I start it? I've been wanting to write for a really long time. Since I moved here, one of the reasons I moved here was to quit everything and start writing. Well, then, that lasted about 6 months, me under a duvet, terrified, walking my old dog every day to get, like, to stay sane. And then I went back to, got offered a really great role over here in horse raising. And so I went back into that just because I needed a foundation, but it was things just keep coming through that needed attention. And one of our mutual friends, Betsy Blankenbaker, is a wonderful writing doula, I call her, because she helps you just like get the time and start pulling it out. And over all these conversations and then watching my friends and other people, you know, get their stuff out of them and into a form that was published, I'm like, okay, I gotta do it. I've just gotta do it. So I wrote it. It took me about 8 months after I wrote it to even publish it, which is really funny. So, yeah.
When you wrote it, was it, how did you feel? Because it's you know, you are questioning every aspect of your life in this book. People understand it when they read it. It is a self-help book, but it's a self-help book, but you've got to really look inside yourself as opposed to they're telling you what to do.
Yeah, because it really makes you angry at some points while you're, you know, like, how dare she say that you don't have to do that, or, you know, and other things. Well, after I finished writing it, I was like, oh, well, this is rubbish. How can this be an actual thing? You know, how can I publish a list? And I have a fantastic writing mentor named Sarah Franklin, and I sent it to Sarah, and I said, it's nothing, it's not normal. And she's like, normal is so boring, Susie. She's like, if other people could do this, they would do it. Like, she's like,
I've never seen a book like it. It's so original.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So I finally got the courage, and I just said, last year was one of those years where you put a list on the fridge and say, right, I got to do this. I either have to, one of the things for me in my writing was I either have to do it now, like publish it and make an attempt at this, or I need to shut up about it forever and get on with it.
Okay. See, you're being hard on yourself again.
I know, but it's really, honestly, I think that's a great motivation thing for me, because it's like, okay, do you, like, I used to be that way with travel. Like, I didn't know, because we were quite poor, traveling wasn't something that was, we did as children or as, you know, young adults. And when I was in uni, I was working the whole time while everybody else was
going on gap years, darling.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, everybody's having these ski trips and doing whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I'm at the cafe, which was good, but it was perfect though. Yeah. It was really
perfect.
Well,
you learned how to work hard.
I did learn how to work hard. And I also learned how to, I learned so much about people. So much of my service type industry jobs were the best thing that ever happened.
Yeah.
But I also have now traveled more than any of those friends ever, you know, because once I gave myself, again, another, just one of those moments where the universe sets something in front of you, a friend who was a photographer had come back from Hong Kong, and he had taken pictures at the race course because he knows that I really like it. He showed them to me, and I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. I wish I could go there. That's, you know, I made this thing out of it. And he's like, it's a plane ticket, Susie.
Wow, he simplified it for you.
Yeah, and that was the, this is, 20 years later, I still remember that conversation because Oh, it just...
Instead of always saying, oh, if only, you just think, no, I'm going to go there.
Yeah, it's a plane ticket. Yeah, it allows you to prioritize it, to save for it. Like, it's not this travel. Like,
instead of thinking it as this big mountain you've got to climb, you just think, no, it's a transaction. You've just got to buy the ticket.
Yeah.
And then if you buy the ticket, you will go.
Like, because another example of me doing that, I have that habit, was I was a member of the London Library for years.
Oh, wonderful.
Which I love.
Yeah.
But, but that doesn't make you a writer.
My husband has a fantasy of spending his days in there.
I spent my days in there even, but I didn't write anything or I didn't publish anything. And it was just like...
A fantasy.
Yeah, it was the part of the fantasy. So last year, I was like, okay, I want to bring this into the world. How... Actually, I asked myself, like, I'm not required to. I wasn't required to publish this book. I'm not required to think about, you know, writing more. Nobody will ever, you know, my value in the world is not, you know, tied to that. But I really wanted to. And that's where that dichotomy between you have to and what you want, you know, and then just being really clear on that, taking away all the shoulds so that you can actually just go for what you want.
So this book can kind of clear out your whole life, can't it, really?
Yeah, I think so. One of, you know, all the best teachers I ever had were people who took down obstacles that you'd put in front of yourself. So it's just a plane ticket. The yes, you can, you know, any of those kind of...
Feel the fear and do it anyway. I mean, I know it's a simple expression, but it really works.
Yeah, and it's those... Mm. It's never anybody who was trying to add a practice, like those... Because I'm a rebel from hell, right? Yeah, so if somebody tells me what I have to do in order to be...
Every day you've got to meditate for 40 minutes.
You got to write for an hour every morning and you have to do it this way.
Yeah, that makes you completely go the other way.
Oh my God, I refuse to do it. Like there's that bit of me that, you know, is me and I have to learn to work with me, not with everybody else, and that says no, don't tell me what to do.
Fantastic. So what effect has this book had on your friends and your business associates?
It's really fun. It's way better than I thought. A dear friend had said to me once that he really admired how I was making my public self all of me. So I wasn't trying to manage my Twitter feed to be only horse racing or to be only literary or to be only whatever, you know, and I was just being me. Yeah. And so this book isn't that big of a surprise to people who actually know me. I think from the outside and you look and you go, horse racing and, you know, industry. And then you look at the stuff that I'm writing and you don't. But if you've spent time with me, it's not a big surprise.
Okay, now let's just talk about horse racing. Why the horse racing world? I mean, I know I love it because my dad was mad about racing and I was brought up near Wetherby. And my only social life was Wetherby races. I mean, I didn't even watch the races. I spent all the time in the bar or I was at a point to point when I was growing up having picnics, you know. So my whole life was, you know, I love racing. But, you know, how did you, as you say, were quite poor growing up, single parent mother. How did you get in the world of racing?
It's really funny. So I was born in Ontario and in Southern Ontario. And
where is that in Canada?
So it's on the Great Lakes. So Ontario's on the Great Lakes. And that's where the area that I was born in. Mm-hmm. I finished growing. I tell you, I'm from Saskatchewan, which is further west out in the prairies, because that's where we moved when I was 10. And that's where I consider my home. But there was a race course in Fort Erie, and most of my family worked at it in some way, not as like trainers or owners or whatever, but as, you know, waitresses or mutual tellers or like betting clerks or you know, grooms or whatever. And I was crazy for horses, absolutely crazy for horses, and that was my way into horses.
Wow, so I realized, so it was round the corner, but there were horses there, so you were just, it was a magnet for you.
Oh, yeah, hundreds of horses right there, and, you know, you just go, they'd have these things called breakfast, like pancakes and gallops, where you'd go have breakfast and watch the training, because there they train on the race course. Yeah. And so, you know, and my grandma was, like, she was this amazing woman, and she collected stray humans all the time, and so she had, like, her basement full of jockeys through the years and whatever, you know, who came to live with us and who were like my, you know, idols at the time. I'm like, oh, you do that for a living? So it was a huge love for horses, and then brought in, you know, matured over time to the absolute, I love when we or other animals and things get to live their purpose. and, you know, watching a horse that has been bred to race, who has taken to it and loves it and participates fully in it, is one of my favorite things. Like a horse that tries, and the dedication of my book is for all those that try, and I mean racehorses too.
Yeah, because I always, my most amusing thing when I watch a race course is when there's a fall and the horse carries on running because it loves it.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing. He's like, that guy's getting in my way. I'm sorry, I had
to
lose him.
Win as well.
And people that are new to the sport are always giggling about that. They're like, and I just love jumps horses. You know, there's not much jump racing in North America. And so when I got over here,
Jump racing.
Yeah. I had a boss that was really passionate about the jumps and opened that world up to me.
Yeah, no, that's because it's all led on from hunting. It's sort of very, very British, you know.
So if you went to pony clubs and then to point-to-points as a child, you lived my dream childhood.
Well, unfortunately, I didn't do the pony club, but my dad did. My dad had a pony called Joey, and that's my nickname, which is really funny. And his dad was master of a hunt. And he was blooded when he was about five.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. It's really dramatic. So they're really horsey. You know, no, really, really horsey. But then because I wasn't, my dad left when I was four. Even though he'd bought us a Shetland pony, my mum had got rid of it because it kept trampling on the roses. But I think if my dad had been around, I would have been more physically daring. I think I was scared on a horse, and I'm wondering if I was brought up by my father and had cuddles from him every day, whether I would have been more physically confident, you know, on a horse.
That's a brilliant observation, because I'll tell you, I had my old fellow, I had a horse for 21 years, the same horse. He was an off the race course thoroughbred, and he was the best partner in the whole planet, and I was so not a match for him because he was so much more brave than I was. And we had, you know, 21 years together of me being not quite brave enough to do what he was capable of doing. And
so he knew that.
Yeah, he took incredible care of me, despite the fact that he really wanted to go and he could really, really jump. And, you know, so we had a couple of arguments about those sort of things over the years. But I wasn't brave. Like, I was afraid of everything for a really long time as an older child. And that, like, I didn't do amusement rides or all
that
sort of thing.
No, I'm the same.
Yeah.
I said to someone yesterday when we went past Alton Towers, and I said, as a child, I would be standing on the side watching everybody else, and I felt like such a loser because I couldn't even go on the waltzes. I couldn't go on. The only thing I could go on was a speedway, which was really safe and slow. Even when I went with my kids to Disneyland, I was scared on the Dumbo ride, and they really laughed.
Did that change for you now?
Well, I'm just wondering whether it is to do with fathers making daughters feel safe.
I wonder. That's a wonderful question. Something I'd like to spend a lot of time.
We both have the same experience.
Yeah. I did flip and went, when I hit my 20s, all of a sudden I was like, I went skydiving and I did. Yeah. I just went, okay, this is typical me. I'm done with being scared now.
Yeah. Well, really interestingly is that I love the stage, and I will get up on stage anywhere and sing and talk and do public speaking. And so many people will not do that, will they? They'll find that terrifying. Whereas I find it's the most, I feel more at home on the stage than anywhere else.
That's a beautiful thing. I'm going to remember that about you.
Yeah. No, but that's like that. A lot of people find that fearful. So it's funny how we have our fears in different places.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah. So if we buy two copies of your book, one for us, who should the other person we buy it for? Who should that be?
Well, I'll tell you the experience of how that's gone, because actually so many people have bought multiple copies, and they usually bought it for someone that they loved who was at a point of change. So either kids graduating, you know, either from, you know, going on to uni or trying to figure out who, you know,
Who, what, where, how.
Yeah, and that really speaks to me because, you know, I did that lack of openness about what you can be in the world, you know, and that...
If you'd had the total confidence at that age that this book has given you.
Or even just a different list of careers. You know, like I went to vet school for like pre-vet med for 2 years because I wanted to be around horses. It's I didn't need to be around sick animals. Like, I figured that out after 2 years of university. But I would say anybody, or if, you know, somebody's struggling with, you know, as we just hit these different moments in our lives, whether it's you're just becoming a parent. You know, I had a friend give it to her entire NCT group. Because you need a lot of permission when you first become a mom.
Oh my God, you need permission to stay in your nightie all day.
To not listen to other people's ideas about what's best for you.
Especially your mother.
Yeah, exactly. There's all those. Yeah. And I think we have those moments at so many different stages of our lives. So if there's someone in your life that is in that right now, it's an interesting exercise to provide them with.
Wonderful. So Susie, have we got the book here? Yes. And oh gosh, I've lost the place.
It's
Can you believe it?
I know where it is.
We are going to read out now just one more Susie's choice in the book and see how it goes. Here we go.
This is the final page. You don't have to wish everyone on Facebook happy birthday. You don't have to work for your equality. You don't have to work it out. You don't have to wonder. You don't have to workshop it. You don't have to worry about letting anyone down. You don't have to worry about being soft. You don't have to worship anything. You don't have to yearn. You don't have to yell. You don't have to zip your lips. You don't have to zone out.
Got goosebumps then. Thank you so much, Susie. It's been a wonderful, wonderful interview.
I've loved being here talking to you. Thank you, Josephine.
And A Little Book of Permission is published by More Than Merrier Limited. I really like that name. And you can contact Susie and buy her book on slsourwine.com. And if you don't understand how to spell that, just look on the website. It's all there, darlings. You'll always find inspiring women on Radio Gorgeous. Sign up on iTunes or go to our website, radiogorgeous.com.